Hey there. It's time for Cultivated Audio, August 2022. Our first guest is Mark Shepherd. Mark stepped out of the garden many years ago and walked through the forest. He hasn't looked back. Restoration-styled agriculture was born. I spoke with Mark back in 2013 about his then newly published book, Restoration Agriculture, and like any regenerative system, its relevance is with us today. Then we've got Diane and Ian Haggerty from Western Australia. They are owners and managers of over 13,000 hectares of cropping and grazing farmland. The success of their system of natural intelligence farming is reflected on their thriving properties and in their highly sought-after merino wool. You know the drill. Grab your earbuds and/or a shovel and let's dig in.
So, Mark, what's your beef with how Henry David Thoreau lived his life? He was a peaceful man.
What a great way to start. Well, my beef wasn't necessarily with Henry David Thoreau. He was a great inspiration. My beef was it just seemed rather incongruous to me that, like, Mr. Naturalist at the time, the guy who, like, studied more nature and understood more of nature than most of his contemporaries at the time, had to resort to getting his food by chopping up a chunk of prairie, burning it first, then chopping up the sods, flipping it upside down just to grow a couple hundred pounds of potatoes and beans. And if you look at most of the time that was actually spent during his Walden project, it was spent taking care of his annual food plants that he required for his carbohydrates, proteins, and oils. And from my perspective, that seems to be the big bugaboo of agriculture. I'll put the word agriculture in quotes. Agriculture as it exists is only about 10,000 or so years old, and it's the concentrated growing of annual plants, you know, corn and beans and rice and wheat. Annual plants only grow for one season and then they die, so we have to destroy a currently existing ecosystem. Henry David Thoreau destroyed a prairie in order to grow his potatoes and beans. Well, potatoes and beans, once you've harvested them, there's black dirt just sitting there washing away in the rain, blowing away in the wind, oxidizing in the atmosphere and in the sunlight. It degrades the resource base in order to grow, you know, some starch and proteins. And I think that's the state of the earth right now, is the fact that we have destroyed ecosystem after ecosystem in order to plant our beans and our rice and our corn, and we need to turn it around.
Yes. Well, I think Henry David Thoreau would appreciate meeting you if he had had the opportunity.
Except I would probably eat the ox after it pulled my plow across the field.
But not the liver, I hear.
Well, I'd eat it, but I just would have to mix it with herbs and spices because I'm not really a big liver fan.
Right. I'm just laughing, folks, out there, because when you read the book, you'll read that here we are with Mr. Full-On Farm, and he admits to not liking liver. So anyway, you have a lot of cohorts out there, fellows.
Oh, good.
Yes. Mark, are you out on a limb? The organic, sustainable farmers / ranchers like Joel Salatin are making great headway these days. Does the restoration agriculture way of doing things fly right past this average sustainable way of living?
That seems like a interesting choice of words, and I'm not exactly sure of what you were attempting to get at with the question, but that's okay. I'll go ahead and answer what I think you asked anyways. and that's where I came from. I was born and raised an organic kid back when, if my dad said the word organic when I was little, he could be arrested for being a socialist. And that's true. That's no joke. So we've come a long way, a long, long way from there. Well, it's not the end all and be all, because in one sense, annual agriculture, if you're going to grow corn organically, is really no different than growing corn chemically, you still have to destroy an ecosystem and expose the soil and plant your annual seeds, and they still only grow for a few months, and then they leave that piece of earth barren for the next, 8 months. Well, in the case of organics, sometimes they'll put down a winter cover crop, but a winter cover crop, my winter rye on my annual plots right now is only like 2 or 3 inches tall. That's not an ecosystem. That's an annual crop with dirt in between these little sprigs of green. And so I see the restoration agriculture model as being the next evolutionary step forward from organics, because what organics had to do is stand up to the abuse from the controlling powers that be and say, no, we don't need poisonous chemicals to grow our food. Well, and what restoration agriculturists need to do now is to say, yeah, and guess what? We also don't have to plow and plant and, destroy the earth in order to grow our organic crops either, and we can out-yield you. And I think that's where restoration agriculture is going. We can restore ecosystem and ecosystem services and produce more calories, carbohydrates, proteins, and oils. Nutrition per acre, annual crops can't come close.
I was going to ask you about that later on in the interview, and maybe we will leave it until then, but I was just laughing because my dad was an apple farmer. And, of course, in 1970, I'm saying, Dad, you have to be organic. And now I feel like one of the questions I want to ask you is, how can you out-yield? What is involved with your claim of increased yield?
What's really interesting about the yield question is so often a single number is, thrown out in, yield of corn per acre, total calories per acre, how much is actually produced. We've got to feed the world, and so we've got to have the yield. And it opens up a whole can of worms. One is that, first of all, corn, if that's all you're looking at is corn, the nutrition in corn per acre, there's not enough, nutrients available there to feed people. The destructive nature of the soil erosion, water contamination, et cetera, of growing annual crops is so disruptive that it's a losing proposition. If we do more of the same thing, grow more of this high-calorie, high-carbohydrate, nutrient-less food product, we'll destroy more of the environment and end up the same way every single civilization that's depended on annual crops has ended up for the past 10,000 years. Another thing when it comes to yield, I may not be able to produce the same amount of corn equivalent carbohydrate per acre if I'm growing things at a perennial polyculture. But part of what restoration agriculture is doing by imitating nature and setting up perennial systems, and a polyculture is many different plants all grown in the same place. By growing many different plants that are perennials year after year that keep coming back, our establishment costs eventually will disappear into non-existence. Then the maintenance costs, such as pest control and disease control, they start to fall into the realm of ecology, and natural cycles take over, and we get a natural pest and disease stability within the system. Well, then on top of that is we end up with a total site yield that's greater than an annual crop yield. I believe it was State University of New York did the research on short rotation woody crop systems. Those are woody plant systems that the biomass, the trunks and branches, are intentionally harvested periodically. And what they discovered is perennial woody crop systems, short rotation woody crop systems, have the potential to capture between 3 and 7 times the total energy per acre as an annual crop field. Using that as a number that's actually been researched, when we set up a perennial polyculture system, sometimes with 7 different crops all growing in the same place, from the tallest tree down to the shortest shrub and having fungus growing in the understory as well, we have the potential to capture more total human food calories per acre. And recent research done in, I believe it was Illinois, has shown that that actually is the case. And I've written about that in the book Restoration Agriculture. The total calories per acre coming off a restoration agriculture planting exceeds that of a cornfield or a wheat field or a bean field. It's just that the individual crops in question will end up being lower. And I'll just use chestnuts as an example. If you grow chestnuts as an orchard in quotes, you'll get you know, say it, 2,000 pounds. I'm just pulling that number out of the air. I don't remember what the number is. You get like 2,000 pounds an acre of chestnut. Well, if you grow it in a perennial polyculture with a bunch of different other plants in there, you may only get 1,000 pounds of chestnut, so you get half the yield. Well, if you get half a yield of chestnuts, and then half a yield of apples, and then half a yield of cherries, and half a yield of hazelnut, and half a yield of raspberries, and half a yield of grapes, and half a yield of gooseberries, and half a yield of mushrooms, how many halves is that? There's a principle in ecology called over-yielding polycultures, and the total site yield of a perennial polyculture exceeds the total site yield of an annual monocrop.
Then, Mark, do you see the human diet changing?
Yeah, I don't necessarily know which direction it'll take on a larger scale, and I'm also not necessarily advocating that we change human behavior or habits, because sometimes that's the most difficult thing to do. And let's just use a name-branded product, Cheetos. Do you know what are in Cheetos? No, probably not. Well, when somebody makes Cheetos, a company makes Cheetos, they're buying industrial ingredients that were derived from corn, for example. They're not putting corn in it. Well, all of the ingredients that you can get out of corn, you can get out of chestnuts. And then there are extra ingredients in chestnuts that you can't get out of corn, and all of the environmental benefits that come along with it. So in theory, what we could do is if we replaced annual fields of corn by the millions of acres with perennial polyculture restoration agriculture systems, somebody in Chicago or Denver opening a bag of Cheetos can radically transform the ecology of the planet just by buying those Cheetos.
And knowing humans, they'll make the Cheetos out of chestnuts now.
Well, because now here's one of the things long term, the cost of actually producing these chestnuts, because it's a perennial plant, over time will go down. And if we have fossil fuel hiccups along the way and prices go crazy, my perennial planting, it will become eventually a less expensive way to produce the same industrial ingredients, less expensive than an annual crop. Then as far as the other nutrition is concerned, if you were to just eat like whole healthy foods, the fresh foods, eating a perennial polyculture restoration agriculture system diet, it's a complete human diet. It's like how human beings evolved or were created on this planet. We were born onto this Eden paradise, and it kept us healthy for millennia.
Perhaps having you tell about your most influential book as a young engineering student will lead us into this story. I loved the buildup, and I'm wondering if you sometimes laugh that it was a book on tree crops from the 1920s.
I was totally blown away when I first read it. It was just absolutely revolutionary to me to think that somebody had the audacity to say that, guess what? Our annual crops, corn, beans, and rice, and wheat, and so on, all we do is we grow these plants to harvest the seeds. Most of those seeds are fed to livestock as feed. Why can't we just grow trees and harvest the seeds from that and feed those seeds to livestock? And so he was basically talking about replacing the livestock feed component. Instead of feeding them corn and beans, you feed them, you know, acorns and persimmons and hickories and walnuts and that sort of thing. Things that humans might not immediately recognize as delicious and palatable and nutritious, animals could care less about. All they want is some food and it's nutritious and all that. And so it was just totally revolutionary to me. It's like, well, why on earth are we working so hard to keep a system alive that nobody seems to be really happy with? So why not restore a natural ecology with, you know, trees and shrubs and vines and bushes and grasses and animals and wildlife and flowers and mushrooms, and sit back and harvest the yields from it for forever? It seemed like a lot nicer lifestyle to me. So that's part of why it was revolutionary.
Yes, and also it went into quite a bit about topsoil. We're all eating foods from dirt not nutrient-rich soil. The devastation has just, from the time, coincidentally, as you mention in your book, the birth of civilization happened right about this time where we started making use and relying on these annuals. Talk a little bit about the topsoil problem.
Yeah, we'll get there from the annuals, but the annuals were always part of human diets. They're, you know, very useful seeds when they were in season. What they were most commonly used for that not many people know, emmer, barley, oats, rice, and corn, the first use for those plants in the human diet was alcohol. So they were in use, but not at the massive scale that they are now, in part because it's so darn much work to get them established. You know, it would be on the fringes of, like, your seasonal camp where it was trampled all the time, or, you know, animal wallows where they'd really trampled up a lot of dirt that you'd see these annual plants spring up, or in floodplains where there'd be silt that would settle and all of a sudden you see these annual plants, or a tree gets blown over in a storm and the roots tear up a piece of bare ground, then you'd see these annual plants. Well, what the annual plants do is they quickly colonize a site. They produce tons, proportionally tons of seeds compared to their size, and a prodigious amount of organic matter that then falls on the soil, or in the case of their roots, decays below the soil. And so what it does is it starts the successional process toward the next stage of soil development. So annuals are supposed to be like the first part of disturbance systems to heal it again and start to rebuild the soil, increase the soil organic matter, increase the fertility. But what has happened is by focusing on that for our staple food crops, we disturb the soil every year, and we never get the benefits of the increased organic matter. We never increase the topsoil layers. In fact, in the Corn Belt breadbasket of the USA, most acres you lose approximately 2 millimeters of topsoil per year per acre. And to say, well, 2 millimeters, that's this thin little slice, a couple of sheets of paper, that's not much at all. But if you were to push it all into one pile, that's a 20-yard dump truck full of topsoil every single year off of every single acre of every single annual crop in the Midwest of the United States of America. And that's insane. That's total insanity. And when your crop is dependent on growing in soil, what happens when that soil is gone? Can you say Mesopotamia, you know, all the civilizations of Southeast Asia, Central America, South America, all these collapsed civilizations around the world have one thing in common. The one common uniting factor is they all depended on annual crops for their staple foods.
What was it in your career, Mark, that got you rolling into it? Was it that book, and it just started that aha moment, and you've been progressively learning and learning? Because I would like to say right now that you've been able to write this book, Restoration Agriculture, out of your experience. It's not where you just looked at things on paper.
Right. Well, as far as the aha moments were concerned, I guess I'm one of these really fascinated kind of guys. And like right now, there is a box elder beetle crawling across the window right in front of me, and it's like the most fascinating thing in the world. It's going up to this piece of something else. You know, what's it doing? I just have this incredible curiosity for nature. And so my getting me to the point of being able to write Restoration Agriculture has been, you know, moment after moment after moment. I had went to engineering school, had an engineering job for a year and a half, couldn't stand it. This book, Tree Crops, was bugging me in the back of my mind, and I decided to quit my job and go back to school for ecology, you know, the study of nature and natural systems. And that was really what got me going, because now growing up in the small family farmette, big garden, homestead type situation in the suburbs when I was little, combined with reading Tree Crops, thinking about a better way of life, how do human beings live on this planet without destroying it? I was probably 7 or 8 when the first Earth Day happened. So that was all part of my upbringing. The Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, all these things were formative, just, you know, pivotal moments in my childhood. Well, then to go to college for ecology and find myself graduating from college in the middle of an economic downturn where not only were they not necessarily hiring ecologists, I think they were shooting them, I'm not sure.
I was just going to say.
So I was like, well, I got to do something. And I had read an article in Yankee Magazine that they were going to close the Homestead Act in Alaska forever. And so I hitchhiked out to Alaska, had a whole series of adventures all the way up there, and claimed a little five-acre parcel of paradise out in the middle of nowhere, and still was faced with the question, how do we human beings live on this planet without destroying it? And that's when I started to really make it real. All of my aha moments, all of my educational background was brought to bear on how do I live in this ecosystem right here, right now, stay warm, stay dry, stay fed and clothed, and not destroy it. How, as a matter of fact, can I actually help to improve its function and efficiency, make it more productive?
When we started this adventure in Wisconsin, we decided to take responsibility for our own food. We were going to grow all of our own food, and that included all of our own protein. And protein at that time for me meant beans, because we were, you know, vegetarian. We were like a lacto-ovo-vegetarian. We'd drink milk and eat eggs. So I was up on a ridge on this 100-acre farm, first year that we bought it, and I'm hoeing, you know, my half acre of beans in order to provide, you know, my protein responsibly. And I was almost dying in the heat because I'd been in Alaska for, you know, 8 years prior to that, had never experienced temperatures warmer than 70. So here I am out in 110-degree heat hoeing the beans, and I'm surrounded by 100 acres of grass. And the year previous to when we got on the farm, a good portion of the farm was rented out to a grazer. And so the animals had been gone for a full season, and the grass was lush and tall and blowing as far as the eye could see, rather pretty, actually. And here I am, I'm dying. I'm literally dying of heat stroke, hoeing my beans and saying, there's got to be a better way for human beings to live on this planet. Why do we have to, you know, suffer by the sweat of our brow, you know, chopping up the weeds in the soil in order to grow a handful of beans? And in total anguish, I looked around, and the surrounding hills on other farms were dotted with cows. And there were these cows eating grass. And I all of a sudden had this incredible aha moment. It's like, wow, these cows are taking something that is indigestible to me. I cannot eat and digest grass. They can. Then I can drink their milk, and I can eat their meat. And so I immediately decided, well, what we're going to do is we're going to get a calf. We'll raise our own calf, take responsibility for it, and then we'll actually get to the point where we butcher an animal that we raised ourselves. Oh, my goodness. So we bought a dairy bull calf, which at the time were a dime a dozen. And we raised it on grass, almost exclusively on grass. And then in the fall, I actually shot it and butchered it on site, and we put it in the freezer. Well, you know, winter goes on and spring rolls around, the snow melts and the grass starts to green up, and I look at the green grass and say, you know, it's time to get another bull calf. Then I went down to the house and looked in the freezer, and it was still full of beef because we hadn't been eating beef. So we counted how many packages of beef we had to eat before next fall in order to get rid of it. And we figured out that we had to have beef at least one meal a day in order to utilize all this beef that we grew last year. And so we started to put it in all of our different recipes. And do you know what we discovered? We discovered that beef makes a remarkable substitute for tofu. Any dish that you would use tofu in, try beef instead. It carries the flavor. It's a complete protein. And we had to laugh at ourselves because we did the tofu thing backwards.
Right.
20 years later, there's this book, Restoration Agriculture, which, you know, basically chronicles my experiences doing my best to apply the principles of ecology and restoring ecosystems to a worn-out, run-down, 100-acre piece of property in southwest Wisconsin. And the results have been a wonderful, hardworking, of course, family life in rural America, you know, raising two wonderful kids and transforming a piece of property into what could arguably be called a Garden of Eden.
Nah.
it seems like there's quite a beautiful community in Australia that's involved with regenerative agriculture, isn't there?
Yes, and even beyond, I think, there's a wonderful network of people, probably a bit like yourself, you know, people that are doing the storytelling, and very supportive group of people, and they're growing in numbers and coming from all different walks of life. And, yeah, it's been really encouraging. And I think the RCS conference, which was held in Brisbane in July, that was a real culmination and an awakening, I guess, too, of how significant this really is and how committed so many different people are to making the changes needed for the planet and for ourselves. And it was quite remarkable, but it's just really encouraging, too, to see the depth of support and commitment from people around.
Yes, and the writing certainly is on the wall. It definitely is a program that is working. And Ian, since we're going to lose you quickly here, could you tell us about your land that you are farming and ranching and what the soil was like on your land when you got started and decided, okay, now's the time, we need to change something here?
The farm comprises of about 65,000 acres spread over a fairly vast landscape. We're in a very brittle environment here. A lot of the times our average rainfall is about 200 millimetres these days. Some years it's only been 100 and some years only 150. It's not big rainfalls to deal with. And some of the farmlands we've taken on are fairly arid land. You know, we're both generational farmers. We were both on fourth generation and Di's third. And we branched out by ourselves and went off and did different things. And when we came back, you know, we realised we were going to change. We needed to look at things differently.
I was just thinking of the question about, you know, what the landscape was like. I mean, lots of varying different types of, I guess, of degradation, and all of it's been farmed fairly heavily. Probably the earliest lands we started on have been farmed for longer periods, you know, well over 100 years. And some of those, you know, there's typical things like resistant weeds and loss of soil structure, poor water infiltration, soils becoming hydrophobic, not letting the water in at all. Huge amounts of salinity through the West Australian wheat belts, and it's a continuing problem, it's continuing to increase. And then also compaction, some of the soils, getting heavily compacted from the practices and fertilisers over an extended period of times, and the tillage from the past, I guess. A lot of farmers in Western Australia now practice no-till, but I guess there's been a lot of damage done prior to changing that.
Yes, of course.
I think our thing that made us see the way to change was actually stepping out of farming. Like I said, Di and I are both generational. Di's an occupational therapist by trade. And by actually not inheriting our own family farms and having to go off and do other things, we actually ended up in what we call the Kimberley of Western Australia, which is right up in the northwest. And we started a business off up there, had a business up there, but we dealt with a lot of our Indigenous people up there, our local Aboriginal people, and used to deal with a lot of communities up there, and spent a lot of time on country with these people. And we got to see a different way how to look and read and respect and listen to country. We always knew we were going to come back into agriculture down into the south, and it gave us a completely different lens how to look at landscape and how to look at things and how we were going to go ahead. And I think when we first came back, we started doing it a bit traditionally because we only came back on a very small farm. We only came back to a 1,600-acre farm that we put a small deposit on. Of course, we had to make things work. But then as things started to unfold, it allowed us to question things, what we were doing. And this was probably started off in about 1995, and then when the year 2000 hit, that's when the seasonal conditions really started changing, and we had a lot of dry years. We just started really questioning things a lot harder and ramping things up.
And what a gift you had in your interim years, being able to see what the folks that have been out in the country and on the land for thousands of years, how they were living, right?
Yes, yeah, it was very fortunate. It thrust us into a situation where we used to spend a lot of hours on country with people, travelling out to communities and that, and probably taught us to actually sit back and listen. And, we were in our early 20s in those days, and probably were thinking in those days not a lot was sinking in, and it wasn't purposely sinking in, but it was.
Yes.
By just sitting back and listening. We were fortunate to meet some really good people up there, and just showed us a completely different lens to look at things. And then as you come back and you get older, we've always been taught if you learn to listen and think about and reevaluate things of what you've actually heard, and in later years that played big dividends to us to actually how we could see things could unfold and how we could go about it and gave us the confidence to go about things.
Yes, and so much of the world was seduced a while back, as you mentioned, using the chemical fertilizers. And now people are gravitating to the regenerative agriculture way of doing things. Since farming is really a daily observation about really what is going on in front of you, and that's where more of that listening comes in, are you seeing people sort of getting seduced into, oh, well, this is the way that you do regenerative agriculture, when actually it might offer a clue or a suggestion, but nothing is the way set in stone, is it, when you're farming and ranching?
Yeah. Absolutely, Robin. That's so true. You do have to be very careful that you don't just fall yourself into another channel, much as the old channels used to be, but just put a different label on it, because it is so much about being into your landscape and its idiosyncrasies and paying attention with lots of observation, lots of immersion in what's going on in your environment to see what helps it along. Yeah, every piece of land is different and is likely to respond differently. Talking about listening and observing is critical with that, and helping it along in the way that it needs.
To do it properly, to get it really right, it's a whole of life approach, really. It's not just a set of recipes that you're going to do on one section of your farm or one side of your farm, whether it be your cropping or your livestock. It's a whole approach, and then you actually start to feel it, and you read it, you sense it, and it guides you into, you know, making those right decisions, working with it, and, you know, lots of wonderful things start to unfold and opportunities.
Yes, and something I've heard, when you're working with your land, for instance, the microbes, of course, we all know by this time are so key and important, but it's not about introducing microbes. As you were just saying, it's your land, you've got to look at it. So it's about stimulating the microbes instead of introducing new ones. How do you all either look at that or actually implement that in your land?
A key one, I guess, for that has been the livestock, and by looking after the gut microbiome in the rumen of our sheep. And we've been doing that for well over 20 years now. So those animals have been very intrinsically integrated with their environment for that period of time, and also having a self-replacing livestock. So the young animals are being conditioned while they're in utero with what the mother is selecting to eat, so priming the youngster's system, and then having the opportunity to graze side by side with mum as a youngster and learn all the parts of the landscape to go to at different times of the year when they're feeling their need for this. If there's been lots of rain or not a lot of rain, or whichever way it might be, and what plants they're needing to seek out to support their own health. But also then got a way that they can access diverse ranges of feed stuff around the farm. And we do manage their grazing under their guidance, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
They're the ones that are leading the way. And we're trying to remove the restrictions on them to utilise their capacity as best they can within that landscape to transfer both microbes and nutrition from all parts of the landscape, so that it is cycled and spread to enhance all different areas. And animals do know that. You see when they go into a paddock that's degraded, whether it's compacted or whether it's suffered from wind erosion in the past or whatever might have happened, they'll go and choose those areas to go and do their toileting, and then they'll move on. They don't continue to degrade that area. But if we locked them up and made them stay there for too long, they could do. But if they've got those opportunities just to do what they need to do and move on, well, that's exactly how they do. So they are our key drivers of the whole system.
You always hear about how animals innately go, if they have an upset stomach or something, they know what plants to eat. But hearing that they know where to go to enhance the field brings it up another level. It's just such a fantastic system. And I know that you all have been involved with developing an acclimatized flock of sheep for merino wool. What, beside what you've just been talking about, has been part of that development? Because the wool is just so fantastically beautiful, isn't it? And healthy. And
yes. And that's what we find has been what's a real eye-opener for us. And I guess you realise how much humility we need as humans, because animal system, plant system, those natural systems have got such intricate things going on with wonderful expression of opportunity if we can just allow that to be. And that's what has happened, I guess, with our livestock. And I guess it's often looked at or termed epigenetic progress these days. But just seeing those outcomes in those animals has pretty well been driven themselves. I don't do a lot of interfering with that. I do select animals really as to which ones that are going to stay for breeding purposes, but it is a very loose parameters on which they're selected. It's mainly just trying to, you know, keep numbers that our landscape can manage within the different seasonal conditions that present itself, so we're not overstocked.
The quality of the birth especially has absolutely amazed us, probably far outstretched anywhere we thought it could go, and is still going forward. And I think that's one other thing is, you know, we don't put parameters on things. We don't put things into boxes or spreadsheets and say, this is what I'm expecting to get, or this is what I'm hoping to get. We just let be what's going to be. You know, we have a bit of a saying, if you don't focus on the amount of money you want to make, or the amount of wool you want to cut, or the amount of crop you want to yield, but you focus on looking after nature, environment, the animals, and doing it right, all that takes care of itself far more handsomely than what you would have ever imagined.
And I've heard you speak about how if you're looking at chemical pesticides and then you want to move away from that and you test your soil and it says, oh, you need potassium or you need nitrogen or something. If you follow the process like you're talking about, I believe I've heard you speak about how those things do end up even taking care of themselves when you focus on the process.
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. Yeah, you get that natural system starting to work right. You know, it's a lot to do with quorum sensing and stimulating things and cranking things right up. And you'll find that all those things sort themselves out. Yeah, you know, and over the years, a few trials and things like that to see what might have been. And it just, the whole natural system just takes it out, hands and feet above. It's amazing. And you find you get a lot of regularity in what you do. It's like the wool clip, for example. You can have a really good year. We're having a pretty good year this year. And then you can have a really dry year. And you'd think the dry year, it'd be off the boil a little bit. You know, things wouldn't be quite as good as a good year, you know, and the quality and that, but it doesn't. It just stays consistent the whole way through. That nourishment in the fibre is there because there's even nutrition for those animals. You know, they don't have to work hard to get their nutrition. And then you find you're not pushing the landscape either. So, yeah, it's just amazing how that all sorts itself out.
Having to work with so many years of drought situation, what is front and center when thinking about the water cycles? Can you give a couple of specific things that you've been able to implement and really seen a difference in working for you?
One of the biggest things has been typically what's been happening in Western Australia has been most of the agricultural country has got annual plants prolific on it, and not a lot of perennials. We've been incorporating perennial plantings of different fodder shrubs and that throughout some of the farms we've worked, but also just ensuring that we can get that longevity even of the annual species so that, yeah, when they might be typically drying off in September, we'll be able to get them to be still be green right into October. So that's one of the things, and we've been using, I guess, the grazing to prolong the greenness. So if we can graze it well through that August, September, and encourage, you know, new shoots that can continue the green right through to October and even into November sometimes. Mm-hmm. But the other thing was on some of these farms that have been, well, across all of them now, been just the return of some of the native summer active species and some of those being perennial species as well, so that we can have green plants growing in the summer, which is not typical in Western Australia. Normally, if you have anything growing in the summer, it's classed as a weed effectively. But yes, what we've found is a return of the native species and a variety of different grasses and herbs and so forth coming back that become really valuable food stuff. But keeping that green across the landscape, you know, as much as we can across that 12-month period.
But we're finding we're getting those natives come back. You know, they come back a lot better if you've had some summer rain, but if you've had not a lot of summer rain or next to nothing, you know, a lot of them are still actually starting to come back and tap into those water cycles. we're actually finding now, even through the cold period, through our winter period, a lot of them are hanging on and not producing greatly, but still have an element of green there, and you don't go into full dormancy. So we're keeping that living root systems in the ground all year round, which is what really pays off.
Yes, I'm sure. And how do you approach growing multiple grains? How did you decide on which grains, and have you made any grand mistakes you could share, or had a certain success where you felt like, oh, that was really a good move that we made there?
We all make plenty of mistakes, and I think that's probably one of the things about learning. You know, it's probably not trying hard enough if you're not making enough mistakes. So it's you're always out there having a go. So we've made quite a few mistakes over the years. Not what I call anything a major mistake. It's all just a learning curve. We started with the base of things, and then slowly it's just developed. You know, we'll just try different things and mix different things, and you just let that unfold. It virtually just tells you yourself. You know, we don't really set out a set recipe, right? Like, and do this, right, and this. We just let unfold, and, you know, it kind of just tells you what to do, what to mix, you know, what to go forward on.
I guess we started off primarily with a focus on cereal grains because they were probably the most reliable in this climate zone, and we were a little bit concerned about some of the legume plants or brassicas that once they were harvested, there wasn't much left in the paddock and what they were, you know, doing for the paddock. And then we've been able to increase the diversity over time of what's growing in our multi-species cover crops and things. So we've just been adding to things each year, I suppose, adding the diversity in, and that's just been improving the productivity all the time. I guess you've still got a, you know, long way to go, but still just making different steps towards increasing diversity all the time. Yeah, so that we've got that capacity to produce what we need and, yeah, put that back in where it's needed somewhere else.
What has your journey been like using biological fertilizers?
That's a pretty broad statement, biological fertilizers. I think in the early days, we tried a few biological type fertilizers, a few systems. There was a number of companies all around the place. And yeah, we had varying success. You know, there was always a lot of different advice of do this and do that. And we found that it was creating a lot of work, all these different recipes and all these different things we were doing. And it was actually costing a fair bit of money as well. I don't think we were quite getting the results. We weren't getting there where we really needed to get. It wasn't really ticking all the boxes for us, and probably got a little bit disillusioned with it at some stage. And, you know, we were trying all different liquid brews through, you know, our boom sprays, you know, foliar brews, and having things work and not work, and block boom sprays and that, and it was all getting a bit frustrating, which I think where every farmer's been. So that's when we had to strip it right back and go back to basics, make this work. So we had to sit back a bit, you get caught up in it all and look at where our roots were up in that Kimberley and what those First Nations people were telling us. And there is another more natural way of going about it. So that's where we started on our learning process. Di went back and she did some study of Elaine Ingham just to expand her knowledge on the side of things. And we just started looking into a more natural process like our own like worm juices and compost extracts and things like that.
Now, in your journey, you've certainly taken on more and more acreage and work with more and more people. What is a main thing that you tell people when they want to switch over and not work with any chemicals anymore and they just want to really start appreciating and giving back to the land?
I guess the first thing to say is you're supporting the seed with a really good microbial seed dressing so that whatever environment you're starting off with, that plant that you're trying to grow is as supported as it can be against whatever toxins there may be in a soil, whether it be acid, subsoil, pH or something like that, so that you've got that plant you're trying to grow protected. How you can quickly take out things like fungicides and pesticides, they're probably the easiest ones to drop out of the system immediately, and building that immune system function of the plant, you know, with that microbial support there, I guess. So from our perspective, the one that's been taking longer to remove is actual use of herbicides, because we won't, you know, use tillage to a large extent to control weeds. We prefer to allow the soil to change itself, change its ecology, and that's what we've been noticing up here in the Mollerin area that where we're farming now. As those natural plants, those summer active plants return, the soil ecology's changed, then the expression of what would typically be called winter weeds, they just don't seem to come anymore. As I said, the easiest ones to knock out first are your fungicides and pesticides, which are the most damaging anyhow.
Yes.
And then address that soil ecology, it all just starts to come together itself. But it'll come at its own time. I don't know how to speed that up other than using, your multi-species cover crops and things that can help things along the way. But, getting that diversity back into the system and aren't required anymore. The indicator plants, which we prefer to call them, don't have a job to do anymore.
So if you are in a transition stage when you first start off, just look at things. Look at how reduce the effect of some of those chemicals. You can drop those rake backs and buffer them up with some buffers to make them a bit softer. And then also with your compost extracts and worm juices and things like that, start to get a detoxification process going. So once you get those microbes going, what residues are there that can be eaten up and detoxified very quickly? Just look at all ways they've actually been able to back off on the harmful effects.
Yes, it's kind of mind-blowing that the chemicals can be eaten up or destroyed by these microbes in a year. They can be gone, totally gone.
Yeah, it's absolutely blown us away of what can be done. We've taken on land in the past that's had years and years of continual cropping regime and, had huge amounts of chemical put on it and gone into it in a one-year process. And with our knowledge, and gone on it pretty hard with a lot of detoxification biological stuff and our oldest genetics of sheep and then tested produce off that within the 12 months that first growing season and had it come up totally chemical-free. So it's just amazing that what that detoxification process can do. It really even surprised us greatly.
Is there something that you think about after you have interviews? Is there anything where you go, I don't know why no one asks me about this? This is so key. Or is there anything like that you come up with?
I guess over time, most of the stuff has been brought up, I suppose. But I guess I think you did mention it earlier. It's just that bit about that key observation and listening and integration of yourself with your ecosystem, recognising, your role there. And I think that seems to be coming to the fore a lot more these days. It used to be a case of people still thinking, what can I do to implement change or still have a control factor as a human? But I think over time we realise more and more that the human control factor isn't the important part anymore, that the natural system has got beautiful mechanisms in place to improve itself and then improve our place within it. Yeah, just having the humility to step back and allow that to be the guiding force, I suppose, as opposed to thinking that we need to have all the answers.
And I think one of the key things is actually where you're setting your sights. If you think, I'm going to go down this regenerative movement, but you're still looking over the fence compared to like industrial movement, you're comparing your crop against something else. Well, you're going to look a bit different. There's no doubt about it. And then that you can beat yourself up on what's that, because they've got a completely different growth pattern. Give yourself chance and time to know what you're looking at and give it room to move and let it express itself.
Knowing that you're kicking for slightly different goalposts, because what goalposts are you kicking for? Are you kicking for getting the best yield outcomes, or are you kicking for getting the best ecological outcomes and resilience outcomes for the future of your whole property and ecosystem to perform with whatever gets dished up climatically into the future, which none of us seem to really know how it's going to be, but we're just going to try and be ready for whatever may unfold.
I'll never do anything slightly harming my ecological process for one small short-term gain. So you're looking at a bigger, longer-term picture.
Yes, yes. So what is your favourite part of your day?
Getting upright and breathing, standing upright and breathing, looking at the morning sunrise is a good start to every day.
Well, we do have a lovely spot, or a couple of lovely spots on the farm, actually. We just went out there on the weekend with it. Some of the crew, and where we sit down and watch the sun actually go down across the Salt Lake systems and then a bit of water on the top and just the sky. And as it goes and sun sets, it's just a beautiful time. So those two times of the day are very special.
Yes, certainly sounds like it. And what is your dog's name? Did I hear one dog or two dogs in the background?
Yeah.
That's the old fella. That's Sam. He's about 15 and getting excited with the young pup that we've got out there.
Oh, cute.
Want to go to work.
Mark Shepherd and Diane and Ian Haggerty working hard through the summer. I hope you've been enjoying these podcasts along with some of your good times of summer. We can be found at cultivatedaudio.com or at the best swimming hole around. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for your part in helping make here where we all want to be.